And the cavity magnetron in the end is what resolved the U-boat problems, because they could fit bombers that could fly the Atlantic at night with an anti-submarine radar and depth charges. Right?
Okay, very good, Ed. I appreciate your you giving us this additional information. Yeah, it was just that Wesley sort of started this conversation on magnetrons based upon, I don't know, I'm not quite sure where Lee DeForest came in, but I agree with you. Lee DeForest, quote, invented, end quote, the triode. He had a three-element tube. I also believe, based upon court cases where there are actual documentations of people asking these people how things work, that Edward Armstrong gave a rather accurate assessment of exactly how the Audion tube worked, whereas Lee DeForest didn't seem to have a clue. So I will agree with you. He invented it. He may have not know how the damn thing worked, but in many ways, especially in his case, you didn't need to know how it worked. You just needed to know what it looked like and what it did.
And you kind of gave Armstrong short shrift. He was a true, he was the ultimate radio inventor. He invented so much you can't even count on.
Okay, I don't think I gave him a short shrift. I mentioned, you know, I wasn't going to go through his entire patent. He did super heterodyne, he did super regenerative, he did FM modulation, he did a lot of work on perfecting the Audion tube. He was probably one of the most brilliant electronic engineers, especially for the modern age. He impacted on so many circuits that are still around in legacy radios to this day. So I have nothing but respect. And the degree of sadness that he may have had some psychological depressive disorders, but he was badgered so much by court cases and suits and such that it's sort of a shame that he didn't, you know, get what I think he deserved. It only goes to show that if you got a good lawyer trumps a smart brain.
I have a comment on that.
Sure, Ed.
Now, Armstrong started working on radio, what, around 1905 or something? He didn't kill himself till the 50s. And he was up to his eyeballs in court cases, as you said, and I think things were not going well. And I figure that's why he killed himself. But then, in the end, his wife and his estate maintained the lawsuits and won every single one of them.
Well, you know, all's well that ends well. I would have liked the story better if he didn't go flat on the ground. I don't know how much of this was due to just the general despair of getting your backside sued beyond belief, and how much of it was an underlying depressive disorder that he might or might not have had. I don't know. And he was highly productive. And I agree with you, this happened later in life. But you know, when Lee DeForest was showing up on King for a Day, or whatever the hell that was, where they said, this is your life, Lee DeForest. And, you know, he got the father of radio, the grandfather of television. I don't know what he had to do with television. I think he did an interview once where he said that television wasn't going to really amount to anything. But aside from that, you know, who knows? A lot of people got things wrong. Professor Hertz, when they asked him about his electromagnetic waves that he had discovered, thought that they wouldn't come to any financial benefit. So sometimes brilliant people aren't great businessmen.
Absolutely so. The only what Lee DeForest had to do with magnetron is that the first concept that he had before he got to the triad was the two the anode and cathode tube, and yes, there was no control grid, so that was what actually made the whole having problem with magnetron, not with the making it, but with patenting it. And to actually.
Okay, I don't know what to tell you. Like I said before, I haven't really researched the history of the Magnetron. The Magnetron, the head seems to. I don't know for a fact. I think Lee DeForest got a lot of credit for a lot of things that were kind of dubious as how much he had to do with them. Certainly, I think it's always nice when inventors vaguely know how things they invented work. You know, to me, that's the difference between a scientist and a tinkerer. And I do understand Lee DeForest had nice credentials. He has a PhD in physics from, I think, Harvard. So he had nice credentials. He looked like everyone's grandfather. He sounded very, very serious. I just think he robbed some people blind who probably didn't have as good lawyers as he had.
Well, actually, that was a time when people started thinking about cyclotrons. So, cyclotron that is being used even now, today, in many universities. That was started from the problems that there was with the magnetron. So the original magnetron was difficult to keep operating at critical value. Even then, number of electrons in the circling state at any time was pretty low. It produced the electrons that were, instead of going to the anode, they were actually circling. And at certain point, and there was the magnetic field that was applied to that, and they call it split anode magnetron, where two anodes actually were kind of preventing the circling. But then it looks like there was a good idea for cyclotron to be built and to actually end up throwing.
Cyclotron is a particle accelerator, not electronic.
That is correct, but it's in vacuum.
True.
So the second modernization of the magnetron was the split anode magnetron. But then those two gentlemen that you actually mentioned, the great guys, the Randall and Bott in England in 1940, right? They made a few watts magnetron to be 25 kilowatts. And interesting was that they did it to about 1 kilowatt in 1 week, and it was the war time. And a few months later, they had 25 kilowatts. That was 1941. And to XGN.
Those are peak powers, not continuous.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, they were using pulse radars, so it was running like about, you know, less than a 1% duty cycle.
And now, since we spoke about the magnetrons, we have another weird twist in magnetrons, the lamp. And we have a number of government institutions that were happy to have those magnetron-operated lamps. So the sulfur lamp has efficiency about 90%, 80%, 89%. And some of them even were claimed to have 94%. So we're talking about humongous amount of light power. And some of you remember the 1990s. I remember that time. And in commercial facilities, we had those plasma lamps. And they had something like a Faraday cage. It was like a grid, you could see through it, and it took about 20 minutes to light up. How many electricians remember that time? Dr. Roy, do you remember this light?
Not particularly. I remember sodium lights, halogen lights, all kinds of fun lights. I think there's also a sulfur lamp that works on the same principle.
Well, the sulfur lamp is actually the lamp that operates based on magnetron. And they were in a very wide use since 2005. So how does it work? The sulfur lamp consists of gold golf ball size of about 30 millimeters solid would be 2.5 inches, two and a quarter inches fused quartz bulb containing several milligrams of sulfur powder and argon gas. So those were actually filled with argon, and they had a very thin glass spindle. The bulb was enclosed in microwave resonant wire mesh cage, and the magnetron there was heating that quartz was actually like a microwave oven that we have in the kitchen. And the operation was 2.45 gigahertz, and we could say that we have right now our Wi-Fi is still working at 2 gigahertz, 2.4, and that actually conflicted with big guys. We have the AT&T, we have a big Germany and England industrial giants that were heating up on that concept. That lamp had a parabolic reflector to direct all light in one direction, and the lamp could work 60,000 hours. Later on, they made also the magnetron being able to work about 60,000 hours. So we had the two, the quartz and the magnetron, giving a good lifetime for one price. They were not cheap. Each lamp was about 5.9 kilowatts, so it was pretty much of power, and at 80 lumens per watt. So we're talking about 96.4 lumens per watt. And later models, it says, they eliminated the cooling fans. Maybe somebody remember those cooling fans. And the efficiency was about 100 lumens per watt. The National the Museum of Air and Space in Washington, D.C. used those lamps. We had also plenty of universities and the United States Department of Energy that was using it in and the fusion lighting was also implemented to some sort of the lighting tubes. If you remember, those lighting tubes were just the tubes on the ceiling, sometimes very long, sometimes they were about 30 feet long and even longer. And they had those microwave lights from both sides or from one side only. Anybody remember that? Okay, the end of the story is simple. Big Giants decided to send the note of protest to FCC because the frequency that was used by those lamps was 2.4 gigahertz, and that was wireless spectrum, the cordless phones and satellite radio in North America. The Sirius radio, Sirius radio and HM satellite radio petitioned United States Federal Commission, FCC, to force fusion lighting to reduce electromagnetic emissions of their lamps to 99%. And in America that died in 2005, there was also some attempts in 2012 to reanimate that. They made the technology much better, but the satellite radio license prohibits operation of all RF lights in 2.4 gigahertz band, and that was the end. The Chinese and Koreans decided that they want to do it, and they tried briefly in 2014, it was really good stuff that they made, but I believe the advent of LEDs was what made it completely useless. Dr. Roy, what do you think?
Well, I mean, that would be my guess. The long life, the efficiency of LED-based light bulbs to kind of revolutionize the whole field took away from certainly incandescence and fluorescence, and you're able to get high efficiency. The temperatures aren't that high, and the emitted RF is minuscule. So it's sort of win-win-win. So. And as you gear up to produce more and more LEDs, the price per unit drops. When we first had LEDs, they were kind of a premium product, but now you can buy them relatively dirt cheap, depending upon the manufacturer and the extra features built into them.
And the last thing, Dr. Roy would have something to say, and everybody else, the step. So we have a guy that is passing by you, standing for 3 seconds, 4 seconds, maybe asking you a question, and then all of a sudden he stole all of the information about you. He knows who you are, what is your name, what is your address, what is your telephone number, and what is your card number, credit card number. And I sent to Dr. Roy the email asking him what he thinks about it. So, Dr. Roy.
Well, I mean, this has been going on for a while. Dick, may rest in peace, used to talk about RFID chips. He had done work on RFID chips. And if you look at a relatively new credit card, I just got a new update from my bank. It has those lovely little arcs going out in larger radial length, little symbol that means that you have an RFID chip in your credit card. If you put it near an RF reader, the RF reader will emit a little RF. Your card will absorb it and ping back some binary data. As far as I'm aware, though, the credit cards do not give you all that information. The credit cards give you the information that's listed on your credit card. They give you your credit card account number, your listed name, and the expiration date, and probably your CVN, that little three-digit number that you need for security purposes. It doesn't give you your social security number. It probably doesn't give you your address. But you know, that's the nature of RFID chips. If you don't want that to happen, there are many companies that sell shields against that. There are wallets. I own a wallet that's made out of carbon fiber that acts as a Faraday cage. There are leather wallets, if you're a leather guy, who have a little bits of shielding liner inside that protects you from that type of activity. So there are ways to counter that.
When you are in foreign airport, you're definitely being scanned. Anywhere you move, you go to the deli grocery, you go to buy the coffee, and there are plenty of those devices, especially in Eastern European countries, that scan you and know who you are. There is a notion, I don't know how true is that notion, that U.S. companies to speed up the process for United States citizens. They were actually installing those scanners, so when you were passing by, they saw your passport, but they also had the information on the screen about your credit cards that you have, and they know that more or less you are the person who you claim you are. So does the RFID blocking really work? I have part of a cage made by a very much reputable American company, and I thought that when I put my telephone, a cell phone is not going to answer the phone, all of a sudden somebody calls, and I was very surprised. How come this thing that is full of metal is not blocking the 2.4 megahertz or whatever the frequency my cell phone is using? So the material and the shape and how this Faraday cage is made is important. But anyhow, I read on the outside of the Faraday cage that is for the 300 megahertz mass, less than 200 megahertz.
Doesn't aluminum foil make an excellent Faraday cage?
Dr. Roy.
To a degree, it depends. Faraday cages are, as Ed knows full well, they're not absolute structures. What they'll do is they'll give you a certain decibel of attenuation of the radiated wave. If it's a very thin piece of aluminum, it'll give you a slight attenuation. If it's multiple layers, it'll get higher and higher the attenuation. So the point, though, is if your Faraday cage was designed for 300 megahertz, your cell phone is going into the gigahertz. It's a microwave device, so that's one thing. And another thing is there's a big difference between the amount of RF that's going in the air through cell towers and the amount of RF that's being bounced into your RFID chip. It's a very, there are microwatts going on there. So it's many orders of magnitude difference. And they've done kind of demonstrations where they put it in aluminum foil, or they put it in carbon fiber, or they put it in some other, and they demonstrate that the RFID reader can't read it. So the quick answer to can you shield your RFID devices from RFID readers? Yes, if you are so inclined.
And that's why they tell you to be sure your Easy Pass is on the windshield.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, unfortunately, is that there's competing things in our lives. We would like things to be easy, but we would like to be private and have our stuff secured. You can't have that 100% of either and have it work out terribly well, both. So you got to give it one direction or another. You know, I mean, if you want the ultimate freedom, just have your credit card number and information tattooed on your forehead, and a face scan will do the job. But I don't know of anyone who would like to have that tattooed on their forehead. But that's the general thing. If you want to lock everything away, you can put them in Faraday cages. But then, if you want some easy solution to how to get through the subway system, and you tap on the top of the little token thing, and instead of putting tokens or putting cards in, and it lets you go, and it records it all, you pay the price in privacy.
Okay. So RFID blocking materials can effectively prevent the scanning function of the card or passport. The promoted is carbon fiber or aluminum layer or sleeve, seeing as protecting from contactless attacks at the selling point for some items, as long as nobody around you have another reader. The distance, I'm not sure, Dr. Roy, what is the distance of your credit card to the reader? Some people use right now the app for the buses, public transportation. I don't have yet that card, retiree card, that allows me to drive cheaper, ride cheaper for it. I don't know how it works. Maybe you do.
Well, it depends upon the design of these things. You know, there are a lot of wireless techniques As far as cell phones and applications, they use a near-field device, which is a little bit different than an RFID chip. RFID chips, the general design that I'm aware of, require relatively close contact. You got to be about the most an inch or two, or maybe three, and then you got to make sure that there's not too much RF-absorbing material between the two. You can't, as far as I'm aware, the standard RF chip on these credit cards, you cannot scan them from across a crowded room.
Yeah, the next time I'm paying for something, I'm gonna, I met just few readers that don't want me to put a card in, but just swipe it in. And I wanna see what is the maximum distance between each read. I can only compare it to the proximity card in hotels or the offices, because I have a lot to do with it. And those who allow the trucks to move through the control post in the secure communities. Now the last one, it's about 5 feet, 6 feet. You have your card in your pocket. 5-6 feet, and the reader can read you. So it's up to the power of the transmitter that is transmitting the signal to see the response of your resonance circuit in your card, whether that would be the proximity card to entry-exit, or that would be your credit card. But you never know what this kind. And then it comes back. Also, when we have those, the Easy Pass, all of the booths disappeared, no more young guys or old guys talking and being bored on those bridges. And we can pass, and now we see that they're going to find us anyhow. What is the distance? What is the distance between the reader? About 10 to 20 feet, and the car is moving very fast. And you have all of the metal around the body of the car. So that's interesting. That's why I'm very much worried about our credit cards being read. So it's up to the power of the transmitter in the reader. And the receiver is only receiving the response of the resonance circuit. Am I right, Dr. Roy?
Well, I mean, that's the idea, but again, there's no particularly great reason to make credit card readers long-distance affairs, because that doesn't really benefit the consumer, it doesn't benefit the retailer, it pretty much only benefits thieves. So, you know, unless you're going to jury-rig something and you're going to kick up the transmission power, and I guess theoretically you could manage that. In the particular YouTube that you showed me, they were using off the shelf commercial equipment, and so they were very limited by a few inches, which I think is what's going to continue. I mean, ultimately, we've discussed this before. Privacy is a thing of the past. Eventually, no matter how many people complain and yell about it, there will be face recognition software, there will be cameras all over the damn place, and everyone will know where everyone is. It's inevitable. I don't know of any kind of solution to that problem. If anyone out there has any solution, feel free to pass it, as long as it doesn't include aliens and alien DNA and such.
Okay, some addition I didn't send you the link for it. To it is the stealing data from your phone. Whether your personal files, movies that you made with your cameras, or copies of your pictures, or any other information. It works this way. A hacker is hacking to your Wi-Fi, so that could be a guy next door. He becomes a part of your network, local area network, and now Once he knows your telephone number, he calls your number. When he calls your number, you actually tend to pick up your phone and see who is calling. But some of us, we have, or most of us, we have a password. So you put your password, and then for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, or sometimes 5 minutes, your phone is on. So that means it's password enabled. Now, the person who is in your network is able to see all of the information. You can actually check it by yourself. You connect your USB cable to your computer or to your router, and you can see that another device appears on the network, or you can connect it directly to the computer and you're going to see there's another hard drive. All of your information is available. And to the XGS.
AZ2GS. One thing, Wesley. How the heck does he get access to my access point? I have a WAP2 encryption password on them all. So I'm not quite sure how he can sidle up next door neighbor-wise and log on to my wireless access point without my WAP2 encryption code.
I believe I should not say that on the TechNet, but I can give the information how they do it. Actually, I was a victim of that scam, not any longer. VPN. When you are in local area network, and let's say you have five computers, four computers, let's say your daughter, your son, or whoever is in within your local area network, and sometimes you have a different devices connected. But phone doesn't have to be in local area network. It does not. But it's in Wi-Fi. So if you're on the phone, you have a Wi-Fi connected, so that means Wi-Fi is on and Bluetooth is on. Now, when you're hearing that somebody's calling you, you're actually punching your own code with your own fingers, and you're actually opening the door for that phone now to be unprotected and be open for the local area network because of your Wi-Fi connection. And to XGS.
Okay, you're still losing me where somehow my wireless, my cell phone, according to you, is on Wi-Fi, but not my Wi-Fi, and not with my password. And that's not the way that my cell phone works. My cell phone only knows about my local Wi-Fi connections. I don't allow it to roam and randomly find other people's Wi-Fi for access. Theoretically, you could do that if you were somewhat silly. But that's turned off on mine, and most guys who know what they're doing, it's turned off. So I'm again kind of confused about this.
Okay. So at first, the bad person has to break into your local area network. The means of that, I'm not going to say loudly on, I don't believe that's necessary. But that can take anywhere from 5 seconds to a few days. Depends from the guys who are doing it. And I have a monitor 24 hours a day. I have a monitor, one of the small tablets that is in front of me, and I could look at the traffic in my network. Because it's connected through the Wi-Fi to my network. So now, what I'm saying is, somebody has to get access to your local area network, and they do it through breaking into your password in your Wi-Fi. So that would be your router, and your router has usually it's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's what comes as a standard in most of the routers. And people sometimes change it, sometimes not. Apart from that, there is a guest access, and there is a guest password apart from that. So, and you can log one of the devices, and you can watch what's going on with your traffic. So somebody has to scan It's not easy because most of the routers right now, they have a 5 tries or 6 tries, and often I see that it says on my screen, you were trying your password 5 times, incorrect. Now you have to wait 5 minutes whatsoever. But once they have the access to your local area network, it doesn't mean that they have the access to all of the computers, because each one of the computer has its own password. But then, your phone is not a part of that local area network. It's locked with your password. But because you have a Wi-Fi connected, and most likely you're using your Wi-Fi from your router, then if somebody calls you, because now he knows your telephone number, now you're putting your password and you're actually enabling the access to your telephone for that guy who is right now in your local area network.
AC2GS. Well, I can just tell you personally. Number one, I change the password every time I reset my router and it goes back to that foolish password. Unlike those annual reports of the top 10 passwords, and you know, one of them is password, another is password zero. So I change it. So that's not a problem for me personally. Number two, I turn the access point off on my router, so there's no guests and there's no breaking into it. I use a mesh Wi-Fi network with WAP2 encryption technology. It just recently came online, what, a year ago? And as far as I'm aware, unless you maybe work for the NSA, it's not easily breakable. So again, if you're a little bit wary and you take proper care, I don't really see these as problems. People who don't do anything and leave guest accounts open, well, yeah, sure, you're just asking for trouble.
Well, I see a much easier way of doing it. While you're at home and you don't think that you want to use your Wi-Fi, in the settings of your phone, you put your Wi-Fi off and your Bluetooth off. Now you're connected, you actually disconnected from any way for that telephone to be connected to your local area network. Some of the people also put off the mobile data. And then your phone is absolutely not able to be accessed by somebody else. That's one of the ways of doing it. And yes, you're right. But most of the people who are listening right now to us may say, hey, what's the big deal? I just do a few steps and maybe prevent myself from this hacking. There was a big hacking that took place with Sprint a few months ago. And they claimed that nobody was suffering, nothing was stolen, and only some data was revealed, about 100 million people. That's what usually they say. That's what usually is the information. So we got to just think about ourselves, because the big guys don't want a problem, and we don't want our data to become public. Thank you very much, and that's everything that I have for today. Dr. Ray.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. I mean, I would never want to do that. Basically, your suggestion is cripple your cell phone so that people can't break into it. Taken to its absurd extreme, if you take a hammer to it and smash it into 1,000 pieces, no one's going to get any information out of you. But it's not going to be a terribly useful cell phone. So I would urge people to change passwords that come from manufacturers, turn off accesses that they don't feel that they need, and use the latest, greatest security technology that they have available to them to protect themselves. Are they going to be protected 100%? Is the NSA not going to get your information if they really want to? No. But like locks. There is no lock that will keep everything and everyone out. You just want to try and keep most of them out, or more important, you want to make it easier for someone to break into your neighbor than your house. So with that in mind, thank you, Wesley. Thanks to everyone who participated in this one. Hopefully, Rich is still with us from U2BZ. He had a comment or something that he wanted to offer.
G2R1.
Yes, David?
You were talking about a physicist. His name was DeForest, a great inventor. You know, I think about the language. The language of engineering and physics, science, the language. Not only is it a visual language, but it is also a language of words. And a person who can understand and speak the language of science and also art and maybe some other things might be somehow a little bit more able to do what would be considered more impossible for other people to do.
Well, I don't know if it's language per se. I think it was more of a tinkering experience when it came to Lee DeForest. He read literature. Now, if you want to say that having read scientific literature means you understand scientific language and such, I guess so, maybe. Where it was rather completely described the mechanism, the initial idea of how a diode, a vacuum diode, sort of worked. The theory wasn't fully there. I don't think they really appreciated that there was a thermionic effect where heating the cathode caused electrons to be emitted from the surface, and then when you applied a positive differential voltage charge to the plate, you got a current. And he was, said, gee, let me play with this. Let me put a wire over here. Let me put a wire over there. Let me put a negative potential. Let me put a positive potential. And he came up with stuff. Back in the old days of the incandescent light bulb, Edison didn't invent the incandescent light bulb. The incandescent light bulb was invented years before Edison did his work. What he did was perfect it and produce a incandescent light bulb that lasted much, much longer than the original versions. And that was kind of trial and failure. You tried it, and then you came up with something. So sometimes science is really a thoughtful process, and sometimes it's experimentation, and sometimes it's tinkering.
Well, let's say you're an inventor. You're an inventor. And you have to convince people the value of this invention for something that would be very hard to demonstrate. Maybe, Edison had a prototype of his invention, but he still had to use words to describe it. And, in order to pitch this thing, to people who had no idea, that this language is very important. I don't know if he was a creative person. Maybe he was just a scientist, but I would think that creative people and people who are also scientists that have an edge because they can describe it in words, they can draw the picture.
Edison was more of an industrial technological entrepreneur. He set up and managed a large building of research scientists and set them tasks to do and timetables to do it. And he sold the stuff as well as he entrepreneured. He didn't accomplish something. If it was up to Thomas Edison, your utility would supply you with direct current, not alternating. That was a big argument he had with GE and Tesla, but he was good for promoting himself. He was a self-promotional person. There are scientists very often are the worst promoters in the world, and every so often you come up with interesting stories that demonstrate it. The gentleman who designed the blue LED revolutionized LEDs. Everyone needed and wanted to have a blue LED on their machine. whether it particularly needed one that was blue or not. And electrical engineers couldn't do it to save their lives. And he came up with a scheme. He took it to his bosses. His bosses said it was going to cost too much, and they didn't think that he'd get it right. Turned down the project. The guy worked around the edges of the business without bothering to tell people that he was spending time and money on the project. He brought it to the company. They've made billions of dollars. I think they gave him an award of $3,000 for his effort. So there's a lot of very brilliant scientists who can't sell their products to save their lives, but that's reasonable. I mean, they didn't become great scientists because they were great manipulative people. Otherwise, they would have been used car salesmen.
Yeah, that has a red, green, and blue LED with four leads coming out of it.
Yeah, there's loads of LEDs. There's tricolor LEDs, there's quad color LEDs. But before Nichia came out with how to make blue LEDs, were very difficult because LEDs are basically just glorified diodes. Diodes produce light. They have a voltage drop. The voltage drop is then turned into light, and the light usually is absorbed and turned into heat in the case. You have a transparent cover over it, and it's not in, and it's in the visible light range, you see the LED shining. To get one with a band gap that was wide enough to generate blue-colored light was incredibly difficult and only took place in the 90s, and it revolutionized design. Nowadays, it's almost impossible to get any electronic component that doesn't have a blue LED stuck someplace.
QSL. And maybe the blue LED, it wasn't such an important or great thing, but somebody had the machinery to sell it and to pitch it and to promote it, and then everybody wanted it. It was sort of like that light blue nail polish. You know, at a certain point in time, every woman was wearing a light blue nail polish, you know, and I was just wondering if they had, like, mega warehouses filled with bottles of this nail polish.
You know, marketers do what marketers do. If they see that if there's an interest in a product, they promote it. If there's no interest in a market, they promote it and see if they can make interest. When it comes to blue LEDs, they're kind of a little excessive these days. Once again, there's a lot of indicators that are blue for the only reason that people think it's cool for it to be blue. But blue LEDs are incredibly important. If you have a screen that's made up of transmissive LEDs, you know, micro LED screens, you need a green, red, and blue pigmented LED triad in order to get a white image. You can't do it with just red and green. So blue is very important in general. It has made the production of many things that weren't possible. But in addition, like most things, it has a nice veneer that you can promote and sell incredible amounts for cases where it could just as easily be green or yellow or red. But just, you know, I mean, I know when it first came out, I really liked and looked for blue LED devices. They just look cool.
QSL, Roy. In 1991, Apple introduced the Mac Classic computer. It was around 1991, which is probably right before the blue LEDs came out. And the screen, of course, was black and white. It's a small PC, personal computer. Screen was black and white. I think in 92, that stopped producing color screens.
Yeah, but you're talking about liquid crystal displays, right?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was liquid crystal display. It could have been.
Okay, there's not that many. If it's a flat plane television monitor or computer monitor, back in those days, there wasn't that much to draw from. I think that was even before they really had perfected plasma. So it was a liquid crystal display. It wasn't LEDs. Usually it was a cold fluorescent tube at the rim with light pipes that brought it down, and the liquid crystal displays had color filters on them that selected red, green, and blue. So the image was really a fluorescent bulb back in those days, if it's an LCD.
Well, you know, my teacher at Pratt, 1992-1993, he had a 19-inch color monitor, and from what I could tell, it was a CRT.
Okay, I mean, that was the original color monitor. The cathode ray tube had certain qualities. They were cost-effective back then. You had manufacturers pumping them out with great regularity. The entire concept of liquid crystal displays and flat displays required building a massive infrastructure. To this day, there are massive factories in China and South Korea, and I think there was in Japan, but I don't know if they're still there, to manufacture these things. Just the glass alone required retooling a lot of equipment. Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, there are two things. You could Google, because I didn't. My father was teaching mathematics, physics, chemistry, so that was a very, very rare for the professor to have three faculties. But that was different. Anyhow, in 1960, maybe 61, I was a small child, and I remember when he said to me, there would be a day soon when the TVs will be hung on the wall, like the pictures. So probably he got it already from some news were available. Where that idea of the TV screen hanging on the wall was first introduced, I don't know. And another thing. In 1496, Leonardo da Vinci unsuccessfully tested a flying machine. This is a pretty used for some of his designs. Applications. He was with Wright brothers that may have took some advantage. So the same story is with everything, every invention. There was another a quote which actually applies to me, because there were a few times I blabbed too much about something and somebody else patented something. You must not lose faith in humanity. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not come dirty. And it was Mahatma Gandhi, and the famous words. In other words, is should not see everything that dark. Victoria.
AC2GS, okay. As far as pictures hanging on television screens, hanging on walls, that strikes me as a very common thing in science fiction back in the 50s. I can recall a lot of different movies where the people, all they did was they knocked a hole in the wall, put an actual TV set with a cathode ray tube, left the frame exposed on the outside, and it looked like it was just a flat screen TV. So that's one of those things that I think popped up in people's imagination almost immediately. So, yeah, I think that kind of goes way back to the very beginning of the early cathode ray tubes. It just required technology to improve evolve and change. And I remember when liquid crystal display technology was released to the public. I was in high school. It was the early 70s. And I wanted to do a kind of research project on it. And my science teacher kind of looked at it and said, what are you going to do with that? So again, it's kind of like good old Professor Hertz. He didn't think it would amount to much.
Well, you know, I have a Sony Vega TV, 24 inches. I hardly watch it, you know. It has a great speakers in the front and speakers in the back, so there's sort of like a depth in the sound. But, you know, it's just a, you know, I just don't really care about TV so much.
Okay, I understand. There are people who don't have TVs. There are people who have TVs and don't watch their TV. There are people who do nothing but watch TV. There are people who were brought up, instead of having babysitters, they were put in front of the TV set. And there were other mothers who kept on yelling at their kids that they'll damage their eyes if they look too long at the TV set. So there's all permutations. Some people love television. Other people hate television. Some people think that the only decent television has to be something 80 inches long and has to be 8K and all kinds of things, and other people don't mind if they watch a full-length movie on a cell phone. So, you know, whatever strikes anyone's fancy, you know, as long as they don't ask me to pay their bills.
Do you have a cable TV, Mr. Roy?
I have streaming service. I get my television through YouTube TV, and I have Fios as an internet provider.
Well, the same like me. The last time I saw TV at my home was probably about 17 years ago, maybe 20, no, 17 years ago. Yeah, I don't have TV at my home. The same means of getting information like you do, and to XGM.
Okay, but I mean, I have two flat-screen televisions in my house. They're all, 1080. They're not 4K or 8K. One's a plasma, one's an LCD. I watch television on it, or TV shows, or some such. Just recently, I saw the Dune movie, which I would recommend to any science fiction fan. It was beautifully produced. A lovely bunch of images, and it stayed true to the first half of the book. So if you're science fiction fancier, take a look at Dune. Also, just throw this out for the heck of it, I've been kind of promoting this animated show, probably some of the best animation I've ever seen. It almost looks like oil art called Arcane. Anyone out there who has Netflix service, check it out. Take a look at it. You know, if it interests you, so be it. It's, I think, the number one Netflix TV show of all that they've produced. And I think it has some kind of score on Rotten Tomatoes of something like 100%. So TV's fine. There are very good TV shows. There are awful TV shows, like all things.
Well, television, most people, they pay for cable or internet cable or streaming. If they don't pay for streaming, they get a barrage of commercials, you know. And it's good where you can figure out a way to watch TV and you don't have to pay.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Yes, I mean, all things being equal, it's nice not to pay. It depends on how you're getting there. There are legal ways of getting there. There are not quite legal ways of getting there, and we certainly do not suggest that anyone take the non-legal method. But there are options. There are low-cost options. There are no-cost options. Broadcast television is still functioning. You can stick an antenna outside your house and go that way if you are so inclined.
Right. You could either use an antenna, or, you know, you can do what the barbershop does. There is a cable going by their shop.
Well, I think there you kind of diddle near the illegal portion. I mean, A lot of people, especially in the very early days of cable, it was not at all uncommon for people to splice connections in apartment houses and get free cable services because the cable companies did not have a great infrastructure and did not have any kind of security. Those days are gone. It's a little bit more complicated.